إن الحمد لله رب العالمين هو الذي جعل المسلمين والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله الكريم وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وأشهد أن محمدا عبده ورسوله السلام عليكم. You're forgiven. One moment. Coffee. Alhamdulillah. We have a program today, and it looks like some of you showed up for it, but just to be sure, I'll check and see. Is anybody that's not here yet, raise your hand. I know, I used that joke yesterday. Limited repertoire. So they got an extra room today, by the way. They have a room just for ladies over here if you wanted to get away from these smelly old men. And then they got another room upstairs for more folks up there. So I think you didn't have to turn anybody away now, right? Because we still got people coming in the door out here. They're okay? I'm surprised so many people are turning out for this. I got excited. I want to come and see what's going on too. Now let's get to our subject. Our subject today deals with the role of the Anissa. What does that mean? Women. Women, right. So before we get into it too far, I want to break down some words for you. This is my habit to do that. In English we say woman, and I was told when I was a little guy that that meant woe unto mankind. And you see, I didn't laugh. My sisters trained me well. I don't laugh at those kind of jokes. Smile only. But anyhow. But that's okay, because they also said human meant, you know, a colored man. That human beings had color in them. They said that was human. So they had a lot of crazy stuff they used to say. But in Arabic, it's not about making up stuff and joking around. It's serious. Because the word for a male is rajul, rajul. And for a female, nisa. So it's clearly they're not. What? Say something? Anybody? Okay. If you know a little bit about the Arabic language, then you'll see that nisa is closer related to the human being, which is insan, than it is to rajul, which is male. So you can make a clear distinction there and see that it's not a takeoff of the word man or anything like that. In fact, the one closer to human being in Arabic is woman more so than the word man. And this is just etymology words playing with a little bit. Another thing that we learn, difference of words, is what a woman is all about. A woman is all about having babies. This is why she's called a woman. Otherwise, what would be the distinction? You're talking about a human being, a male and a female. It's like in plant life, you're talking about male and female. You're talking about one that fertilizes eggs and the other one is carrying eggs or, you know, something relative to that. We understand that the place inside of the woman in English language where she conceives is called a womb, okay? And I don't know what that word's related to. I forgot to look that one up. But the word in Arabic is rahm. Rahm. And the plural is arham. This word is related to the names of Allah, because Allah is Rahman, Rahim. It means, in English, more or less, the merciful, the beneficent, the all-merciful. There's a number of words that are we try to bring into play. Graciousness, things like this. A very nice word. And it's not just a clinical term, but it's something that's been used even before Islam came to represent this. It's very nice because a human being starts out inside of a place of mercy, conceived in a place of mercy, and develops in this place of mercy. Some of the embryologists, scientists that have studied some things about Islam, learned the Arabic language, tried to read from the Quran to get a better understanding about these subjects, they were amazed at this, and some of them even offered that we should use words, especially for Muslims who are studying the subject, just use the words from Arabic. Why make up new words for something that was named 1400 years ago and very appropriately named it at the same time? So I'll give you a little bit of insight of something about women from the words. Now let's talk about the condition of women in the days prior to the advent of Islam. As most of you have heard of something called Jahiliya. How many know what I'm talking about, Jahiliya? Okay, but about half of you don't, though. So I better talk about that. Jahiliya, this is called the days of ignorance before Islam came. Everybody was in that in the Arabian Peninsula. Nobody was claiming anything about Islam or Quran or anything because it wasn't there yet. So they would be ignorant, certainly, of that and the teachings that go with it. Human beings in general were in ignorance, jahiliya, and they were, at the best, low class, okay? And at the worst, you don't want to know. Alcoholism was prevalent everywhere. There was, you know, it's so common that if anybody drank alcohol, it would be like, so what? Like drinking water. Fighting with each other was very, very common. Beating people up, killing people was common. Feuds between tribes and families was very common. Lying was not as prevalent maybe as it is in some places today, but they did have lying going on. But it was really bad with stealing. Stealing was a horrible thing in those days. But the treatment of women specifically, you cannot believe it. When we hear about it, we can't believe people would do this to anybody. But they treated the women as though they were less than the animals that they drove to pasture. The women, not only did they beat them and abuse them, they killed them. When a little girl was born to a family, it was considered such a disgrace that they would take the girl, little baby girl, to the desert and bury her alive. And considered it something macho to do that, you know? Because it was considered a weakness to have women. If you had males, good. Women, bad. That was the attitude they had. It doesn't really make sense. If you even think about it just for 1 second with logic, you can see that, are you stupid? Where did you come from? You came from a woman. And there wouldn't be any more children if you don't have women. How can you do this? But many of them did. Not all of them, of course, but many of them did that. And as regards the relationship of a man and a woman, although they might have called it zawaj or marriage, it really wasn't like any kind of marriage that we know about, because there was no limit on how many they could have. As many as you want, because they were treated more like sheep or cattle. If you got a lot of them, macho guy, rich. And they could buy them, sell them, trade them, give them as gifts to each other. In other words, the condition of the women was really unbelievable, horrible at that time in the Arabian Peninsula. It was not that way all over the world, of course. However, I was reading, I like to read a lot, and I was reading in the Encyclopedia of Events of the Catholic Church, and it turns out during that same century, that's called the 7th century, the 600s is the 7th century, and it says that at that same time they were holding or convening a conference, a council, to decide whether or not women even had a soul. And this was taken from some of the verses they had in their book of Genesis dealing with blaming Eve for everything that went wrong. In other words, they're saying the devil came to Eve and she succumbed, and then she goes and entices her husband to partake of this fruit, and because of that they fall out of heaven, and so it's all her fault. And then there's even some verses in there talking about the curse that's going to be on this woman and on her offspring, and the curse of the monthly cycles, and the pain and the agony of childbirth, and the curse on, but it doesn't say any curse on Adam. It's all on her, blaming her. For those of you that know that Islam, Judaism, and Christianity have quite a bit in common, I will share with you, this is not one of the things that we share in common. We were talking about the condition of the women prior to Islam coming. One of the things they didn't have was the right to speak up in public. If they did, they could be seriously, seriously abused. Another thing was there was no such thing as voting. This didn't happen like that. Certain tribal members, or representatives of a tribe, males, only males, could, of course, voice their opinions about things and influence the decisions of the grand modulus or something like that, but not the women. And it would be considered really, really bad for a woman just to walk out and say something. It would be like unbelievable. And the family that she belonged to would be disgraced because of that. Now, if you stop for a second, you said, well, wait a minute. I've been in Muslim countries. Have any of you been in Muslim countries, especially Arab countries? Arab countries? Have you seen something even similar to that today? Uh-huh. Does that mean it's from Islam? Okay, thank you. I think we understood that. Because just because you see something and it's from Muslims or in a Muslim country, don't think that that's Islam saying that. This is people saying that. Okay, now let's come to something more specific. Let's talk about what are the rights of a woman in Islam. Well, I'll tell you that a woman has the right to be treated like a woman. And you say, well, what does that define that? That sounds rather subjective. No, because the creator of the woman is Allah, not a man. So what he says is what is her rights. But also, he says what the limits are. One of the things that I learned when I was coming into Islam, studying especially in Arabic, I learned that translators, and may Allah reward all the people who try to translate this, because it's not an easy job, but they make a mistake very often in gender. When men, and most of the translators of the Quran are men, and when they translate it, I caught something, and I wondered if anybody was ever going to do about it. And then I found a translation that fixed that problem, and I was really excited about it. The ones who did a really good job on it, it's called Sahih International. They're located in Saudi Arabia. I was pretty impressed. I said, Saudi Arabia, you know, come out with something here. It's really, this is good, you know. Sahih International. Wow. Yeah. Because I've been in Saudi Arabia quite a few times, and I didn't think that they would come up with something so well balanced. Let me leave it at that. You know, I need to go back, so I'm going to recap what I said again. But anyhow, when I explain it to you, you'll understand. There's a verse, two verses related to each other, but the bigger of the two is in verse 35, chapter 33 of the Quran, Al-Hasab. And here it's going to set up something for the next verse. And it says about the Muslim man and woman, the believing man and woman, the fasting man and woman, the patient man and woman. How many of you heard about this one? You know which one I'm talking about? Now, did I say something wrong or right? No, I said it wrong. You're like me. You read it and you just think, oh, this is what it says. But it said Muslimin wa Muslimat. Mu'minina wa mu'minat. Sabrina wa sabra. The point, it's saying the full name for the man and the full name for the woman. But when we translate it, we just say, the man who does so-and-so and the woman. And the man who does so-and-so and the woman. And the man, And the whole point of the verse, if you read the next verse, you'll see that it was to show you that a man and a woman both have the same distinction in front of Allah. Because in the next verse it says, because that was just a setup. Because in the next verse it says, it is not for the believing man, nor is it for the believing woman. I'm talking about Arabic, correct translation more or less. That when Allah and His Messenger have decreed any matter, that they have any option or any opinion other than that in this matter. And they accept it. And one of the things the believers say is, we hear and we obey. So Allah was making a point that the men and the women are the same in front of Allah. When it comes to obedience, when it comes to rights, when it comes to limits, it is the same. What's different? The physical body. Yes. What else? Emotional condition. Sometimes women have different emotions than men. Doesn't mean one's better than the other, but that's another factor. But as far as being intellectual more than one over the other, that's not true. We know that today anyway. Also, that a man can't do certain things that a woman can do, this is known. Men don't give birth, they don't have babies. In fact, my wife told me that after she had our first baby, she said, if a man had to go through the pain, she was making fun of men not being able to take much pain. She said, if a man had to go through the pain of giving birth, and Adam had to give birth to Eve, there had never been another child. I don't know. You're right. She said that right. I don't want to know. My wife told me that I was asking, what kind of pain is this? You know, and she said, well, I'll never explain it to you. Men can't understand. She said, but if you want to just get just a sample, grab your lower lip. Go ahead, guys, grab it. Okay? Ready? And pull it up over your head. I can't relate to that. I don't want to relate to that. When we look at the way the Quran came, stage by stage, issue by issue, and then we see what happened, each scenario that took place related to the revelation, for them it was like they were going through the life and stuff was being answered for them at the time. Wow, look at this. Okay, that's the answer to this. Why do those people do so-and-so? Well, then here's the answer here. How do I relate to that? Okay, you do this. So that people had a much better understanding of what it was that Allah had created and what He wanted to do with it. What's interesting is after that 23-year period, that we find today, many of us, when we open the Quran, it speaks to us. Hey, that fits my situation today. How did that work? Because even though some events are very clearly relative to something that took place then, many of the events and things it's talking about are general enough, although it applied specifically to them, we can apply it specifically to us today. So let's take one of them for instance. What are some of the rights that we would think about today that are really, really important, that really need to be addressed? And in my country, women had no right to even vote in the election 100 years ago. 100 years ago in my country, a woman could not vote. My mother told me that her mother was very much interested to know about what's called women's suffrage. And now this, when my mother was a little girl, at that time, this was going on. She didn't really remember it, but her mother talked about it. Can you imagine this? Women couldn't vote. And there's still places today where women really don't have much say-so. But the whole entire country, the United States, supposedly all about freedom, supposedly about freeing the slaves. It was in the late 60s, 1860s. But still, a woman, she doesn't have the right to vote. They finally get the right to vote, but did that cure the problem? Everything was okay? No. In the 1950s, to open a bank account, my mother had to go get permission from my father. And by the way, she was older than him. And when she wanted to buy or sell a piece of real estate, not only he had to sign it, he had to sign on the top line.
And if he wanted to sell any of her real estate, he didn't have to take her permission. She'd have to really fight in court to try to get anything out of the sale of something if a man wanted to do that. I know about this because my parents owned real estate. They dealt in real estate, and I can remember issues coming up when mothers have to call him and say, come over here and sign this thing, please hurry. And, you know, things have to be notarized. It has to be his signature. And he didn't have anything to do with the property, except that he was the husband. Then, even into the 1960s, we still had the problem in some states that a woman couldn't buy a life insurance policy without the permission of her father or her husband. So, oppression is in many ways and in many places. And unfortunately, a lot of things that come out of the news front page aren't necessarily the big issues to you and I. The things that we'd like to see corrected don't make it there until it's noteworthy to somebody else. But in the case of Islam, it's not based on human beings. It's based on what Allah is revealing to the people. Now, for those who don't believe in Allah, they just say, okay, this guy's just talking, we don't have to listen to that, and that's fine. Because one of the things, and I think all of the ladies can confirm it, probably most of the men, but you can see the status of the mother. We're going to take the mother first. What is the status of the mother in Islam? Somebody came, a man came to the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and he said, after Allah and his messenger. So you see what I'm talking about there. Allah has to be first, the messenger second, because he's the one coming with the message. After Allah and his messenger, who now has the most rights on me? Who? Now, stop and think, what would be the answer today, what some people might say in different societies? They might say the government, they might say the king, they might say the income tax guy, they might say their girlfriend, or they might say, you know, might say a lot of stuff. But who has the most rights on me after Allah and his messenger? And then who? And then? And then? The mother, the mother, the mother, and then the father. Now, I think the mothers make you guys memorize that when you're 2 years old, right?
But it is in Islam that the mother is first and foremost above everything, because at that time, the mother had nothing. So this was another thing that came in the face of these people looking like, come on, how am I going to go to a religion like that? No way. Give them another excuse. No, this is not what we do here. It was another excuse to reject it. Another thing, when they started talking about a newborn baby, we talked about the mother. The mother gives birth. Let's say she has a little boy. Whoa, let's get out here. We're going to slaughter a bunch of sheep, camels, feed everybody, bring all the tribes together, big celebration. Another macho male born to my clan. But then, what if she has a girl? Ooh. And they have an expression in Arabic, they become yellow-faced. It means, oh. And this was their attitude. Serious attitude. To the extent that many of them would take this newborn girl to the desert, according to their custom, and bury her alive in the hot burning sands. Something so disgraceful to a Muslim that one of them who had actually done this thing, after Islam came, he was recounting that and crying about it. And actually the story is that he was crying and then he laughed. And they went to him and they said, oh, Amir al-Mu'mineen, he was the leader of the Muslims at that time, we saw you laugh and we saw you cry. What was that about? He said, well, the crying was when I was thinking back about before Islam came, the ignorance that we lived in, and the custom we had about taking a baby girl to the desert and burying it alive. He said, I did that. And I was crying about it, feeling remorse, bad, you know. He said, but then I remembered something else that we had as ignorance too, that we used to worship just whatever, you know, as a god. And when the people used to come to Mecca with their gods to worship and go around the Kaaba and do all their stuff, some people came and I didn't have a god and I wanted to worship something, but I had some rotab. Rotab is the dates that are still on the stick. He said, so I formed it up and made a god out of it and I was worshiping it. But there, later I got hungry, so I ate it. The Quran clearly says about this that it is not only forbidden, but it tells you what's going to happen to anybody that takes the life of their children, especially a little baby girl. On the day of judgment, she will ask, "For what sin was I killed?" So the one who did such a thing as this, he is really in deep trouble. Because also in the Quran, we find a general statement that came to Bani Israel before us. The children of Israel were given the same kind of command, but it was general. This is specific. The general command on this is in chapter 5, I think it's in verse 32. It says, more or less the English meaning of it is, whoever takes an innocent life, it's as though they killed all of humanity. But whoever saves a life, it's as though they saved all of humanity. So this is something really big. This is something really, really profound to notice now that not only you can't do this, but you will be charged as though you killed all of humanity on the day of judgment. This is really serious. So as these people would get away from their ignorance and come into Islam, these were some of the things immediately they wouldn't do anymore or regret had they done them in the past. It changed people's lives tremendously. People that were formerly drunks were introduced to something called sobriety, but it came in stages. Let's go now to another issue. We talked about the mother and what's her status, and the Arabic expression is, "My mother is on my head." This is an expression. It means that everything for my mother, whatever she needs, I'm going to do it. If the mother says, "I don't want you to stay home today," that's it, I'm staying home. If she says, "I don't want you to do business with that man," that's it, I'm not going to do business with him. My mother said, "Don't do it." I've seen it happen. There is some real good respect for the mother and her decisions and her wants. Now, we talked about the baby girl. Now, as the girl grows up, she also has rights. There are a lot of rights that go along with being a Muslim girl. Some of the things that we in our societies, various societies around the world, we might not appreciate. But one of them is that she has the right of being protected against a lot of things. So for this reason, the girls start out in a protected atmosphere. They're not just thrown out with the dogs or something like that. We kick the boys out during the day, but we don't kick the girls out. The girls will stay close to their mothers, and they'll learn a lot of things from watching their mothers. As they get older, though, when it's time to learn, there's no difference in the education. The girls learn, the boys learn. But where they learn? Because it's easier, especially for the mother, to teach the girls at home than it is to send them out and then wonder if they're okay. So when they're small, this will be the case. When girls reach a certain age, and we all know which age I'm talking about, now there's a new kind of protection needed to go in place to keep these wild animals from chasing them around. I'm talking about guys. So if she goes somewhere, then we want to have her father with her, her brother with her, uncle, somebody who will keep a close watch to make sure that somebody doesn't get overly excited. So there is that protection. The other thing is the dress code. Let's talk about the clothes. Now, in Norway or Sweden, the countries I've been visiting, there's not a big emphasis by the non-Muslim women to worry about what they wear, or actually what they don't wear. But for Muslims, no, this is part of the criterion for the ladies. There is a dress code. But a lot of people don't know there's a dress code for men too. The men also have a dress code. In fact, the dress code for all Muslims, all the believers, is from the navel to the knee, all the way to the center of the knee, to the middle of the navel. Has to be covered up. And that's all the time. Even just lounging around the house, this needs to be covered up. So, and by the way, for the men, the upper area is to be covered anytime he does his prayers. And it's preferred when he's running around if he has a garment to wear, because in those days the people were pretty poor. Having two garments would be a luxury to some people. But if he has an upper garment, he should wear it. We learned that. As far as wearing any footwear, that's going to be kind of obvious. If you run around with no shoes on, you, what happens to your feet? So that's not really mentioned that much as far as, you know, being an obligation. It's common sense to cover your feet. But now, whenever there's going to be a strange man around, then the woman is to cover up, and it's telling her more than just covering up in general. It tells her how to cover up. This is in chapter 24, verse 31. Again, though, men very frequently don't refer to the verse before it. So we're going to go there first, and then we'll come to 31. Verse 30 says to Muhammad, peace be upon him, tell the believing men to lower their gaze. And the phrase here is very clear, not to be checking out the women. That's exactly the idea of, hey, baby, I'm right. Nope. It is, yeah, if you look to say something like that, that's okay. You can have, they have what they call the first glance is permissible in Islam. And one of our brothers came from Saudi Arabia, had never seen any women except all covered in black in the streets. And so when he came over, we saw him in the airport. He's waiting for us to pick him up. He's like this. And we're like, Abdullah, what are you doing? I made up the name. I said, what are you doing? He said, don't bother me. I didn't blink yet. That's not true. I made it up. But we do see some of our brothers that seem to forget that you know, the ladies, they're a treasure. The women are a treasure to Allah and to the believers. And they're to be regarded as such. And not to be insulted, not to be put down, not to be treated in a bad way. We have a responsibility to remember that. And in you think that got me. Okay. But anyway, the thing that we're trying to say here is that the women have rights for you not to stare at them. And then it continues and says, cover your private parts. Protect your private parts. And all of this is better for you if you're a real believer. The next verse tells the believing women, because the Prophet is told now by Allah, tell the believing women to lower their gaze. Same thing. Guard their private parts. Same thing. And to let down their khimar over juyubahin. What is khimar? Many people translate the word khimar as veil. But actually, khimar is not something you really can see through, and a veil is. The khimar is something that used to be worn on the back of the head, and it was long, covering the hair. So here it's being said to, in this case now, let it down over the front too, because juyubahin is from like jade, pocket. It means the crease between the breasts. Cover up. That's how the motion of bringing it down over the front is how a lot of people thought that it should be, that the face also was covered. Now, after that though, one of the imams, which was Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal, was asked about this, how should it be? He took his covering, pulled it around him, but he could still see out of it. They could easily see one of his eyes, and he said, like this way. So a woman's hands and face can show, according to the ruling of most of the scholars. A few take the opinion, know that it has to go all the way down over. But I haven't seen anything strong enough to indicate that for me, but I'm not trying to pretend to be a big scholar either. The other thing that comes about, the rest of the clothing for the woman, this talks only about the top part, by the way. But what about the rest of it is mentioned in another verse in chapter 33, verse 59. And here it tells the believing woman that, actually it's telling Prophet Muhammad. It says, Ya ayyuha an-nabi, O my Prophet, kul azwajika, tell your wives, wa banatika, your daughters, and the believing women, that whenever they go out, to draw their garment all around them. So this is where we get the idea of the burqa, or in some cases the jalabiya or whatever that they use. But the idea there is when she goes out, that she doesn't define the shape of the body. Because then Allah continues that if it is something is seen, or you know, it's not her fault, then Allah is forgiving, merciful. But she's just basically trying to cover it up when she goes out. So this is the clothing. Now, a couple more issues. They're telling me we're out of time, basically. A couple issues that are really, really important. One of them is about marriage, and another one is about divorce. And I really would feel remiss in my duties if I skip over those two things. So I'm going to have to give it to you really fast. You ready? Okay. Now, when you get home, slow that down and you'll get the whole story. And I am going to refer to it, inshallah. The first part is about marriage. We're going to look to a chapter. There's a chapter in the Quran called An-Nisa, that is the women. So it makes sense if you have a woman question, look in that chapter. It's not the only place it talks about women. It's not the only place it talks about marriage. It's not the only place it talks about divorce. But it is a central place for you to start with. Start there and watch right from the very beginning. A'udhu billahi min shaitanir rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Ya ayyuhal-ladina, ya ayyuhal-insanu, taqu rabbakum alladhi khalaqakum min nafsin wahidin, wa khalaqa minha zawjaha, wa batha rijalan kathirin wa nisa'a, wa taqa la tasa'amun bihi wa arham. Inna allaha kana alaykum raqiba. Allah is telling us from the very beginning that we should have taqwa for him, which is to fear his punishment. And when he's telling you that, because he's getting ready to tell you an order about how important it is to understand something here, that Allah created all of us from a single person, Adam. And from Adam created his spouse, and from those two brought forth many women and many men. Rijalan kathirin, one nisa, and women. And then he says to us, that we should be very careful about, you know, because we say, and he says, have fear of Allah, because you demand your mutual rights by him, but how about giving your rights to other people? How about that? You want your rights. By God, I want my rights. So people say that in English all the time. But you're swearing by God for your rights, but what about giving other people their rights? And this leads us into the chapter on women. Because in the second verse, and this is sad, because I've seen so many people, even some of the Muslim scholars, forget to quote this verse, and then it gives a whole different opinion of what the third verse is. The second verse is telling us, again, continuing, you should have fear of God when you're dealing with people. About who? Yatim, the orphans. Especially orphaned girls, because again, at the time of revelation of Quran, the people were horrible in the way they treated orphans, especially girls. If a man died and he left behind a girl, then all of the property, they would say, belongs to the man who marries the girl. She doesn't get it, but whoever her husband is. But in the case, what if she's 2 years old? They would say, I married this girl. That's my wife. It wasn't about sex, it was about money and power, okay? That's my wife, anybody big enough, come on, try me. So, he gets the wealth. They did that. Don't take their money, going back to the Quran, don't take their wealth, mix it with your wealth in hopes of bettering yourself while you're claiming that you're doing it for her. Marry, now it comes to the subject. Marry your wives to ithna, thalatha, arba, 2, 3, 4. If you can treat them with equality. Otherwise, wahid, one. You realize the people of that time didn't look at this as being an opportunity to go out and get a bunch of wives. They didn't go, wow, oh, we can get, no, you already have wives. They saw it as what we talked about in the beginning, a limit. It was the first limit set. You can't have more than four. And some of these companions of Muhammad had more than four wives. They were forced to do something about that. They had to find another place for them. They had to help them either get married, whatever, but they couldn't have four wives unless they could treat them equally. Then how do you treat four women equally? Who here can imagine such a thing? And then it says only one. These limits were strange to them. Very strange. What are you talking about? I have to treat them equally. Like what? If a woman married to you has a nice car and a nice home, nice clothes, now you say, well, I'd like to get another wife. Even at that time, it meant you had to get another home like that, another car like that, and set her up the same way, yes or no? Otherwise, you're abusing her rights. Well, I don't know how financially well off you are, but for me, of course, I'm lucky anyway. My wife told me when we got married that one woman from Texas is equal to four from anywhere else. So you already have your limit. For the Muslims around the world today, they're the most really monogamous of all of the societies that I've visited. Most all of the Muslims where I go, they have one wife, and they consider it a big joke. A joke. It's one of the jokes that I will tell when I got some of the youth around me. I say, how many wives do you have? And they always start laughing right away. Ah, funny. Because it's ridiculous. How many of our youth are here today, somebody under 21 years old, don't even have one wife? This is your chance. The girls are looking. You can raise your hand. But anyway, so we can go into that in the question and answer portion of the program. I think more detail, but I wanted to touch on that so we could look at that. Because you take that out of context, it has a different meaning. That was in the very beginning of Surah An-Nisa. Let's jump up a few verses, verse 19. O you who believe, you cannot inherit women against their will. So this stopped something else that they used to do, forced marriages. Now you say, well, wait a minute, I heard that Islam is all about forced marriages. We hear that all the time. You see it on the internet, see it in newspaper, and other places where you keep your garbage. I couldn't resist that one. But it's true that some people do this, but it's in direct violation of that order. Women cannot be forced into anything, according to Islam. If you do it, you will pay a great penalty with the law. A serious penalty with the law. And if you don't believe it, wait. Wait. And go look up this word in Arabic, istidraj. Go ask somebody that knows Arabic what that means. You'll find out. You don't want it. Don't ever take away anybody's rights, especially in a case like this. And that verse clarifies even more the first verse that I read to you. The one about the orphans. Moving forward, another verse, I have to skip over a lot because of the time. Another verse that's again misquoted says, and you find it on the internet and in articles attacking Muslims, it says, in their book, it says, beat your wives. You heard that? I don't know about you guys, where you come from, but in Texas, my wife has a big iron skillet that hangs on a wall. Her sister, this is a tradition in her family, her sister gave it to her when we got married. I said, that's an old iron skillet. You should have Teflon. You can cook on it a lot easier. She said, it ain't for cooking. Kind of scared me because right after that I was joking around. I'm a character, you know, I'm always having fun. I was teasing her about something. She didn't like teasing, you know. And she just looked at me and she said, you got to go to sleep sometime. Okay. There are people, always people, who will try to manipulate things, both within and without, the outside of Islam. But just because somebody's manipulating something still doesn't make it true. What's true is that the verse that I'm going to tell you about is a beautiful verse that shows the balance in a marriage relationship between a man and a woman. It starts out a general statement about all men and women, but then it becomes clear that it's also talking about particularly for the wife and the husband. It starts with the word rajul. I told you earlier the word rajul means what? A man, a male. It says males are responsible for the upkeep, and this is talking also about the custodial care, the financial responsibility as well, for all the women. Now this is general. You can look at it yourself. If you know the Arabic language, this is a general statement, meaning that there's no such thing in Islam as a woman on the streets living out of a shopping cart or something. Because all the Muslim men are responsible to help this lady to have a place to stay, to have food, to have protection, to have warmth in the winter, coolness in the summer, whatever we are able to have for ourselves, we're supposed to provide for the women in general. Then it becomes more specific when it starts talking about, because Allah has made one more kawi than the other. The man's more able to go out and do these things, so it's his responsibility. In Islam, who is the one that is supposed to pay for the house, the upkeep, the maintenance, the utilities? Who? The man, right? Some of the ladies are going, really? You're in trouble. It's serious. Because it's happened to me that some Muslim women have asked me, what percentage of my money am I supposed to pay out of my paycheck to help my husband with house payments and car payments and all the rest of it? I said, are you serious? I said, yeah. I said, I know that percentage exactly. I have trouble sometimes with the zakah, 2.5% of what you hold over a period of blah, 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 blah. But this one is easy. Zero. And she's like, huh? Now the brother was somebody close to me. I knew him really well. And he got kind of upset with me. He said, you know what she did? She turned in her resignation and quit her job. I said, tough. It's not your responsibility to do that. So this is why in Islam you do see a difference in the way women are treated when it comes to going out and having careers and professions and businesses and so on, because it shouldn't be that she has to go do that kind of thing. If she is inclined to stay home and have babies and take care of them, this is the natural thing. You make it easy for that. But if she wants to go out and do something, want to own a business, Islam absolutely does not forbid that. The Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, his big job that he had in life came from his wife who owned a trading company. Yes or no? Okay, duh. There's some other things too I really wanted to talk about, but there's just didn't time. Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, never had a girlfriend. We mentioned that. His first wife that he married wasn't until he was 25 years old. And he was a virgin when he married her. But she had been married twice before, and both of her husbands had died. So there's nothing wrong with marrying a widow. Absolutely. This is the sunnah of Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. The Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, not only married a widow, but after she passed away, he married a lady who was really large, a very big lady named Sauda. And nobody made fun of that. They considered that to be a very good thing. He also married a lady who was very old. And it wasn't for sex, because they were clearly saying, she said it herself, that they didn't have sex. But he was marrying her to care for her so that she had a legal companion to travel with her, do whatever she wanted to do, and provide for her. So when new guys start talking about having more than one wife, go back and look and see why and what he did. Because the more you think about it, the more you realize this is a lot of responsibility. This is a lot of work. Duh, yeah, that's the whole idea. And we don't have to tell you about having fun. Everybody knows about that. But having even one wife. A lot of you are not married yet. I saw that when you raised your hands. Well, I need to tell you, having even one wife is a big job for you. And you got to grow up a lot. And you have to take on a lot of responsibility. But then, if you take another wife, you'll find out about something really big. Really big. You'll never have time to do anything else again in your life. I'm serious. But for the most part, as I said already, most Muslims, they get married once in their life and they stay married all the rest of their life. And this is good. This is a very nice direction to go, because in most cases, that's a very compatible situation. But in the case where a woman is unable to bear children, a man doesn't have to throw her out and say, well, too bad, I want to get a wife that's going to have kids. He can keep this wife and take another wife and have children with her, and as long as he maintains both of them the same way. But he doesn't have to do that. Now, let's go the other way. Let's talk about divorce. If a man wants a divorce, we hear people say, all he has to do is walk up to the lady and go, I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you, take a hike. Steve Martin even made fun of Islam when he did one of his things about that. But that's okay. The fact is, the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, said, they said, a man did that. And they said, so is he divorced from his wife? He said, yeah, he is, but he's sure not from us. He wants to be divorced, okay, but he's not from us, not that way. Because a woman needs to know what's going on. She needs to be told. They didn't used to do that. They just walk up and smack them, beat them, even kill them. And there wasn't anybody to really stand up for them, except for their tribal mentality. If you kill somebody from our tribe, then we'll do something to you. But if you beat them up, well, that's different. So now the next part of the verse, it's saying that she is devoutly obedient. Some men said that means to me. But that's not true. In Islam, it's impossible. Allah is always first. Obedience here is first to Allah and to His book and to His messenger. Nobody's asking her to take on this guy as a god. And then the next thing it says, on the part of those whom you see, not suspect. That was a really bad thing one of the translators did when he said suspect. Because if you read another part of the Quran, you'll find that suspicion is forbidden in Islam. And it's clear you've observed that there is something called nushuz. Nushuzahuna. Now this nushuz means something literally in Arabic that is so out of place, it's bizarre. Something bizarre. Something really bad. Without describing it. But the implication is clear, that it's leading towards something immoral, but something really bad. But it doesn't say what, so leave it at nushuza. In this case, admonish her. Why does it say that? Because their habit was just beat her up. Just beat her. But it says admonish her. But then to be sure that he understood it, that, okay, I'm mad at you, you gotta stop doing that, now I'm gonna punch you out. No, because the next thing after that it says, leave their beds, meaning not to have intercourse with her. What does that mean? Well, that's going to be at least 24 hours, isn't it? So he's got time to calm down. Calm down and get over it. So that he doesn't react to whatever it was she did in a violent way. And it worked. It toned down these guys tremendously because, okay, now I have to be careful. I can't just react. She did this, you know. And he tells her, I don't like that. That's not right. And she's going like, what are you going to do about it? Okay. So now he doesn't have intimacy with her. Oh, God. He's serious. The guy's serious. Ah, okay. Then it said, wadribahun. Now, daraba is the verb that's used here. Some of the scholars have said that it means that you cannot hit them more than a toothpick. They even use the demonstration of a toothpick and hit themselves, saying, no more than this. But daraba in general means hit. It even has this meaning of, we use in English, how does this hit you? How does this grab you? Alam tara kayfa daraba lahu mathla kalama tayyiba. Do you not see how Allah hit you with something mathla like? Okay, so it carries a lot of meaning. Another meaning for it is to return back to the bed, because this kind of darba also means to have intercourse. But when people take this out of context, and men have done that, take it out of context and say, this is the verse that gives me the right to beat you. It's actually the verse that stopped people from beating them and made it clear that they had to go through these stages, calm down, don't get up, you know, go crazy. And even in one of the scholars' thesis, he mentions that this is actually another form of admonishment, a stronger kind of admonishment. Because in the very next verse, and hardly anybody takes the time to read the next verse, it tells you to immediately go get somebody from her tribe and somebody from your tribe to act as mediators to bring you back together, to work it out. You both agree to it. Now, how, if you know tribal custom, what I've been trying to explain to you all afternoon, if you understand tribal custom, how do you hit this lady and then go tell her father, by the way, I beat up your daughter, and so you can see that couldn't have been the meaning. There is one that I've offered on our website that you can look at, because I kept looking for the word in English that could mean the same thing exactly if a man wanted to talk about this, because hitting with a tooth stick, we don't have a word for that. Do you know any word for hitting with a tooth stick? I don't know it. But we do have a word for what a doctor does when he examines your chest, upper respiratory specialist. When they check you, they put their hand on your chest and then they tap their hand like this. That's called percuss. And that's about as strong as any of the scholars have ever said. So if you want to look it up and see, we have it on a website. You can find it for yourself. The subject of divorce, I'm going to have to let it go for now, as well as some of the other topics that are related to the women in Islam. But I do encourage you to get the questions written up in one way or the other. We're going to try to take care of all of that. And you're welcome to stick around if you want to, and we're going to come back with some more of this, inshallah, God willing. I ask Allah to forgive me for any mistakes, and I hope that we didn't confuse you, or maybe at least we amused you, right? سبحانك اللهم وبحمدك اشهد ان لا اله الا انت استغفرك واتوب اليك The young lady that accepted Islam here yesterday told us last night something amazing, how it came about, that she was looking and searching, and it came to her in a dream how to find the answer. And by getting with the Muslims, looking into Islam, she found what she was looking for. And all of us can find the same way, but start by asking him. Don't ask me. That's how I get out of answering any questions. Okay, I know you're not going to let me escape that easy, right? That was worth a shot. We're gonna do that now. We're going to take the questions, inshallah. I want to congratulate all of you, really, on being so patient. Your patience and your cooperativeness, working together and making room for each other here, this is really, it's amazing. And especially how long you've had to sit and listen to me cackle on. You guys got a lot of patience. You got class. You got style. I think I could turn that into a song. Got class, got style. I don't know.
You too.
By the way, I heard they're replacing Jay Leno, and never mind. I'm not working, you know. I've got a nice surprise for you, but I'm going to save that for a few minutes because I'm going to try to take a couple of questions. Yeah, some of these are not really pertaining to our topic. I think a couple of these you can just ask your imam, your local imam, and in some of these cases he'll smack you, and you deserve it. But in most cases, I think, some of the stuff you say, come on, man. It's about circumcision. This is the removal of the foreflesh on males. That is what Islam is talking about. And if anybody is doing anything to the females, this was not from the Quran that I know about. No. If some women do something like that of their choice and they think that's cool, I guess that's up to them, but it's never been anything mandated for women. So if you hear about this, I will tell you that it was a practice in Africa long before Islam came, and it's still a practice amongst some Muslim women who live there, but it's not coming from Islam. I think it's coming from their long history of doing that. Here's a question. I'm going to ask this question, but then I'm going to ask you two or three more. Why should Muslims wear hijab? Why should Muslim women wear the covering or hijab? Another question I'll put with that. Why should Muslims abstain from eating pork? Why should Muslims pray five times a day? Why should Muslims do Hajj? Why should Muslims fast Ramadan? Why should Muslims even say they're Muslim? If you're a Muslim, you already know the answer. If you're not, you don't need to worry about it. Isn't that true? Nobody's asking the non-Muslims to wear hijab, are they? Because this is the identity of the believer. It's also the identity of the good Christian women and the good Jewish women as well. Even today, the best of the Jewish women, you'll find them, they cover. You didn't know that? Before I came here, I was in New York. There's plenty of Jewish women there. And you'll look right away, she's Jewish, because she's wearing, their covering doesn't cover their whole face like it might with the Catholic nun who is wearing something much more involved, but also a lot of them shave their head. The Jewish women shave their head and they wear wigs. You can't see their hair. They cut it all off. I'm just not joking, this is true. So if a woman is not a believer, she doesn't believe in the Bible, doesn't believe in God, then good. Now we know who's who. But if you're a believer, it's in the Quran telling you what you're supposed to do. If you believe in the Quran, why don't you follow it? An evidence of belief is acting on what you believe. If you don't believe, then that's pretty obvious. You don't act on it. You just say it, but you don't do it. Okay. Here's one that's asking the question, why are men separated from women? Is there any women here that want to go sit with a man? No, I'm asking. Let me give you another question. It came to me like this. I was giving a talk, and a woman, when we got to question and answer, she came walking in the door, and just like this, she said, I want to know how come you Muslims can have four wives, but a woman can only have one husband. It caught me off guard, you know, and because I didn't expect somebody to talk to me that way, you know. And I said, excuse me, are you married? Yeah, what of it? I said, well, why don't you imagine your husband just for a second? She said, why? I said, no, just think about your husband. What he looks like, you know, he's coming home from work, he's sitting down in his favorite chair, everything. Yeah. Would you like another one just like him? No way! I said, then what do you want four? Of course, then I had to give the regular answer, but just, you know, it was pretty harsh. Another harsh one came in to me one time. Again, it's question and answers. A woman, it was in university, a woman came in the door, and an older woman, and she, by the way, she was dressed very conservatively. And she pointed at the Muslim sister. She said, I want to know how come they're dressed like that. And I'm like, huh? Why are they dressed like that? And it shocked me. Again, I couldn't think. because it wasn't about the answer. It's about people being that rude, you know. And I said, well, excuse me, but what's wrong with the way that they look? She said, it's not logical. I said, your logic. She said, yes. I said, okay, then I'm going to ask you a question. Why are you dressed at all? She got angry. She said, what? I said, why do you have any clothes on? She said, what? I said, well, how were you born? What were you wearing when you came out of your mother? How were you dressed? Let me help you. You were naked, nude, in the buff, no clothes, right? She's like, oh. I said, now I'm going to ask you again. And by the way, she was wearing her dress, come all the way down like this, and down to her ankles, and all the way up to her. It was just like a Muslim dress in many ways. Really, it was. So I said, again, why are you dressed like that? And now she's angry. She said, modesty! I said, now ask these ladies why they're dressed like that. You'll get the exact same answer. The only difference is going to be it'll be modesty according to the one who created them instead of modesty according to something they made up. And the ladies went crazy. They thought that was fabulous. And the lady left. She stormed out. And when she did, the brother next to me said, that was my history teacher. I think I just failed. She was a very fair lady. She did not fail him. He got a very good grade, by the way. But why do the women and men separate? And it's very simple. In many cases throughout history, we know that men have taken advantage of women in many different ways, not the least of which is just to stare at them and make them feel uncomfortable. Also, when they pass by men, men will touch them in a way that you can't really say, hey, that man, no, just passing by, you know. Hey, just, you know, like, hey. Men do that, and that's not new. You don't have to be from Italy to do that. It is very forbidden in Islam, and especially I want to take you back to the time of the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. If somebody had done something like that back then to one of the women, they would have killed them. There wouldn't have been a heartbeat. You touch my wife, you touch my sister, you're dead. That's it. So there has to be a balance, a good balance. Women are told exactly how and where and so on in Islam, just like the men are told how, where, and so on, as far as dress and mixing and not mixing and so on. But sometimes people carry it to another level and they get confused. And it has been 1400 years, and I'm not blaming anybody. I'm not picking on anybody, but I am asking all the Muslims to go back to the source and look. Now, I want to talk about not here today, because you guys, for whatever reason, you're sitting like you are. Good. But at the time of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, he did not have any kind of a division between the men and the women in his place of prayer. Did you know that? There wasn't anything there. The women sat in the back on their own, and the men sat in the front on their own. And he told them that the men would get more reward in their prayers by coming to the masjid for their five-time daily prayer, 25 to 27 times more. But the woman receives more reward by praying in her home, in the most secluded place, most private of places, that the man has to pray with other men to have a big group, but the women don't, and they get the same or more reward than the men. It's a lot easier for her. She doesn't have to get dressed up, doesn't have to go over there, and she doesn't have to leave the babies behind. She doesn't have to leave food cooking on the stove. She's able to tend to what she does. Very simple for a woman to perform her ibadah or worship in Islam. If she wanted to go to attend the services in the morning or the evening, she would go, as many of the women did go, and then they would be in the back. Now, if there wasn't going to be any talk or anything like that, they would just simply get up and leave even before the men turned around. That's how they did it. Today, we've added something. You can see these artificial lights in here that are so bright that there's no way, in any time, day or night, that a woman would have the advantage of this kind of covering, because they used to have that. That there was darkness and they could slip in, slip out. You might say, oh, there's some women over there, but you didn't know who or what, and they didn't have to worry about what they had on. But today, it's very difficult. If a woman, for instance, if a woman has some jewelry or something, she's not supposed to show that off. So now what would she do? So if she has a baby, what would she do? You know, in Islam, a woman nurses her baby for 2 years. Well, now, for 2 years, you're not going to go in public? You're going to leave your baby? You can't leave the baby. What do? Islam gave a very nice solution. Women have this thing that comes over the front. We talked about it, the khimar. She can actually put the baby under it to nurse. And nobody can see. But that's kind of uncomfortable. And it's kind of hot. So if she's sitting in the masjid and she would like to nurse the baby, men added a partition across so the women could be behind it for their convenience. Many of the women said, hey, this is great. After the prayer, I can take off my head covering and everything and kick back. Ah. And enjoy the program. And today we still do the same thing. Some of our brothers in Islam perhaps didn't research this far enough, and they've made it mandatory for all women have to go behind this thing, and they have to sit this way, they have to do this. And you'll hear what they will say. Well, I will tell you, there's no evidence for it in Islam. There isn't evidence for that in Islam. The other thing is, in some cases, I have to support the brothers when they say, we cannot have any women come to our prayer on Friday. Because look around this room right now. Do you see how many people are in here? And how many other rooms we've got are filled up right now? And how would we do it if we had to cram everybody in here to do prayer? We couldn't. So they asked the women, you're going to get more reward by praying at home. Let the men come and do their Friday prayer and then let them get out. That's why they did that. But it wasn't because they were trying to deprive the women of anything or to make them feel bad. It was just simple logistics. And we encouraged them to build bigger mosques. Of course, then you got a problem. As soon as you say we want to build a bigger mosque, then you got all the people saying, no, those terrorists are back and they want to make bigger bombs. So the men are caught between these things. They're trying their best. And in many cases, they, I think, are doing a good job. Some cases, the men go too far. They say things that are not really established from Islam. But may Allah guide all of us. And I'm sure I made more mistakes than any of them anyway. Just today. Almost out of time. I wish we had more time about this because so many things about what's happening in Islam today, and women especially, that it's not from Islam, but it's from human beings. The other thing is also, in general, the things they say about Islam in pertaining to your enemies or pertaining to Jews and Christians, those things are distorted or twisted to an extent that it makes me sad. You didn't ask about it, but I would like to mention it myself if you don't mind me to ask myself a question. The question is, why does it say in the Quran that you can't have Jews and Christians as friends, and why does it say in the Quran to kill all the Jews and Christians? Why does it say that? The answer is, it doesn't say anything like that in either case. These are things that are being twisted way out. In some cases, Muslims twisting it, and in some cases, non-Muslims twisting it. The first one is based on two words in Arabic that are mistranslated, bitana and awliya. Awliya, it says, don't take for awliya. Awliya doesn't mean a friend. It means an ally, so that when you're in a war, you have allies, you know, like countries do today. And if somebody's not of your faith, you don't bring them into your wars with you. You don't bring them in as allies because it's not fair for a Christian to defend the faith of Islam, is it? Although it is correct for Muslims to defend the faith of the Jews and Christians. And we've proven that for the past 1400 years. There's a pocket of Christians, we talked about it yesterday, who are living right now in Syria, who have been there all this time, surrounded totally by Muslims and protected by Muslims for all these times, still speaking the language of Jesus. And Mel Gibson had to go there to get the language from them for his movie Passion of Christ, because they're the only ones left on earth who still speak that language. And by the way, we have a prophecy saying that this is the place in Syria. We know that in Damascus, this is where Jesus is coming back. And that's the place where today the only people who speak his language are still there. Just thought that. Throw that in. There are many things. The word bitana, this means to have the inside lining of your coat. Who do you put close to you? This close. Close is your deodorant. Huh? Even from some Muslims, you don't make them your bitana. So you understand how that is. The reference that they say, kill all the Jews and Christians, it doesn't even say Jews and Christians in it. It doesn't say Al Kitab. What it says only, waqtuluhum. This is what it says. But it's in relation to the verse before it, using kittel, and they translate it as fight. The word was actually kittel. Kittel actually means to kill. Fighting and killing, like in combat. Because if you read it in context, you realize that you're fighting against people that are fighting you. Because it's telling you, again, a limit. They were limited. They used to kill everybody all the time in their open wars and feuds. But now it was saying, you can't do that anymore. It says you can fight them if they fight you. That was the first time in 13 years they were allowed to start fighting. And it said, fight them where they fight you. But if they stop, you have to stop. Otherwise, you're the transgressor. Verily, Allah does not love transgressors. Then in the next verse, and combat them in mortal combat, meaning to kill if they're killing you. Listen to this. And drive them out from where they drove you out. Ain't no Christians or Jews drove any Muslims out anywhere at that time. This was a specific verse about something that just happened. It was talking about the idolaters who were their own relatives that had driven them out of their homes, killed them, raped their women. It's saying now if they're fighting you, you can fight them back, get your land back. It says, and get your property back from them. Get your home back. Take it back. And it was talking about the people of Mecca. So when you stop in the middle of a verse and then add words that don't belong there, that's not Islam. I wish that we had time to do more of these. I really do. But in the meantime, I think what we can do is just tell you that your questions are good, really good questions. And some of these are not exactly on our topic. Some are personal. I don't like to ever do personal things for in front of a whole crowd. It's not fair to you or the person that you're talking about. So I'm going to ask you to just consider this. If you will, write your questions down and then submit them to us at justaskislam.com. But before you do, go to searchforislam.com and type the keywords in to be sure we didn't already answer the question and make it simple for you. Searchforislam.com. Justaskislam.com. Scienceislam.com, pertaining to the topic that we just had. And here's the one, I saved the best one for last. It's our newest website, really cool, islamswomen.com. There's no apostrophe, just put islams with a S, women.com. I think you'll like it. It's got a flash program in the beginning of it. Yours truly standing there going crazy. And, but I think you'll like it. It has a lot of answers. And men, you can go to that website, but you have to lower your gaze. Just kidding. Zakumullah here. It's great to be with all of you. Till next time, peace. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.